Okay, good morning everybody. Hope everybody is well. A few important hakdamot to the shir. First of all, yes, thank you Miriam for reminding me. Please turn off, if you can, turn off your phones or put them on to vibrate. Please put your masks on, so it's masks on, phones off. So get it that way round, please. First of all, I'd like to start with an apology for turning up last week. I did say the week before that there was a 95% chance I wouldn't be there last week. You always have to be choshesh for the 5%. So the 5% was that due to complicated COVID rules of getting into America after you've been to England, I had to cancel my England trip and put that at the end of November. Please God. But there were a few people who were a bit... cross, as they used to say back in the old country, that people that I turned up, or not angry that I turned up, but that they didn't know. So one of the old-fashioned ways of dealing with this question is they suggested I send around a sign-up sheet here today that if you wish to put your name and email, then you can be notified as to last-minute changes on the ship. You don't have to put your name and email then, but if you don't, then don't complain if you didn't know what's going on. I do apologise last week if there was any inconvenience. If you want to pass that around, if you'd like to sign up, that would be great. Just looking forward, I hesitate to say it, but there is a 98% chance that I won't be here for the next 3 weeks. So I am planning not to be here next week, the week after, or the week after that. I think it's unlikely that will be cancelled, but who knows? I don't think so, though. However, you certainly have a treat in store, because next week and 3 weeks from now, please God, Rav Azaria Berzin will be giving the shiur. He's very well known to everybody here, needs no introduction from me. A very well known local Magid shiur, Talmud Chacham, and he will be giving the shiur this next week and 3 weeks from now. And even closer to home, Rabbi Shor, who will be giving the shiur 2 weeks from now. He already told me what it's about. It sounds absolutely fascinating, issues of Kohanim. Maybe he'll do that one, maybe he'll do a different one. But I definitely encourage you to come next week, the week after that, to hear Rabbi Shor, to hear Rabbi Berzin. And please God, Chanukah week, I hope to be back here at the podium on the Wednesday morning of Chanukah, where we will move forward. There are all sorts of interesting things that I would like to revisit. If you remember, we're having a mixture of new topics and revisited topics, but the older topics were already 5 or 6 years ago, and most of you were not necessarily here then. And if you don't remember then, or if I've certainly added new things, I'd like to do a series, revisit a topic which is very close to my heart, which I have a lot of new sources on, which is women's connection with Talmud Torah. That is an incredibly important topic in today's world, one of the most important Talmud Torah topics. I'd like to revisit the issues of Mashiach and Tchias HaMesim, which will come up a little bit today. And I'd like to revisit the issues of going on to Har HaBayit. These are all topics which we haven't looked at for many, many years. But today, I'd like to complete the group of three issues dealing with the medical ethical questions. And before I start, I'd like to announce the sponsorship. The Shiurim all through the year are anonymously sponsored in the merit of an aliyah for the neshamas of Masas Yahu Ben Yisrael, Aaron Ben Menachem Lev and Eliana Bas Yaakov, very gratefully received as a sponsorship for the whole year. And specifically for today, a full day of learning in the OU has been sponsored anonymously again, but in a merit for a refuah shleima for a very sick young child. Many people may have received notice about this, a young child, Nebuch, in a coma. And we are certainly davening for a refuah shleima, the Daniel Rafael Ben Leah, with all other Chayli Yisrael. Please God, they should have a schus to have a refuah shleima. And what better to learn about is a schus for refuah shleima as issues of saving lives. That's what we're talking about entirely today, saving lives and different kinds of lives, because we're not only talking about saving lives of the organ donor recipients, we're talking about saving lives of the donor themselves. It goes in both directions, and we'll see how that works. Okay, there's a lot to be said. Trevor, do you think we need the air on? I can see already, if we're already hot at 10:18, then there's no hope for 11:18. There is an enormous advantage to hearing this shiur from a doctor, and not from a lawyer. My expertise is law and rabbinics. And even though I could say, trust me, I'm a lawyer, I suspect many of you have had enough life experience to not do that. But I'm not a doctor. So the big disadvantage is that what I'm going to be telling you, I'm sure if you know people who are listening who are in the medical profession will say, oh gosh, that's oversimplified and it's not really like that. And that is that. But there's an advantage as well, which is that it's oversimplified, and I'm not going to complicate matters too much because it's not my area of expertise. But I would strongly suggest, if you want something more, much more detailed on this, as follows. I recommend in English, I mean, there's an enormous amount of material on this, but in English I'd recommend you go home and read the following. First of all, the Rabbinical Council of America put together a 110-15-page document about 10 years ago on the issues of organ donation, analyzing all the sources that we're going to be talking about today in much, much more depth, going through all the responses of the classic post-GIM, the contemporary post-GIM, etc. Their conclusion is, as we'll see why soon, that organ donation is from a brain-dead patient is not halakhically recommended and may not be halakhically permitted, and the tenor of that document points in that direction. That's one thing I recommend you should read. And the counterbalance to that is you should go onto the Halakhic Organ Donor Society website, the HODS, H-O-D-S, where their clear natiya, their clear inclination is that brain death is halakhically considered death, and therefore organ donation is to be encouraged wherever possible. And there you'll see enormous amounts of resources, and their natiya is in the other direction. So if you want a balanced view, that's what I would certainly say is the way forward. But I will try and give you a balanced view today. I just won't be able to do it in that amount of detail. Okay, fine. Let's start at the very beginning. Around the world, most people, when you ask them, are in favor of organ donation in principle. But most people do not carry organ donor cards. There may be all sorts of reasons for that cognitive dissonance. But, for example, the average in Western countries is around 40% of people carry organ donor cards that say, if God forbid, in the event of my death, then you can take the organs and save someone's life. In the United States, a couple of years ago, it was 54%. In Israel, it is around 14%. That's much lower. And if you go back to 2006-7-8, before the new legislation, it was 4%. Why is the percentage of people carrying organ donor cards in this country so much lower than in most other countries? We'll talk a little bit about this. As a result of that, Israel had, and still has, all over the world there is, but Israel particularly, a chronic shortage of organs to save people's lives for transplant. We'll see maybe why that is. In 2008, there was a new law that was brought into effect in Israel, which I've referenced at the bottom, the Organ Transplant and Cerebrorespiratory Death Act. In 2008, which changed the definition in law to brainstem death. We'll see how that works and why they did that. The aim being to increase the number of people who are carrying organ donor cards, and now there are a number of organizations through which one can do that, some of which are under rabbinic auspices, some of which are not so much. We'll talk about that towards the end. It is hoped, I'll say right now, that in 10, 15 years from now, this whole shiur will be historic. And we'll all turn around and say, oh, those were the bad old days when we had to wait for someone's organs, because the big hope for the future, it's not the immediate future, but the maybe medium-term future, is either xenotransplantation, where we can take organs from pigs, organs from baboons, and which is a basically limitless supply, and save as many people's lives as we need to. Obviously, halakhically, that is completely uncontroversial. There is as long as the surgery is relatively sure of success, or at least there's a high chance, there's no problem clearly having an organ from a baboon or a pig. It's pikuach nefesh. You're not eating it anyway. Who cares if the animal's kosher? It's not even relevant. So that's one great hope. And the other, which I know some of my own students are working on this, is 3D printing of organs. One of my own students is doing a PhD in 3D printing of pancreas organs, and hopefully there will come a day, obviously it's much more complicated than this, that someone can just, you know, type into your 3D printer, heart please, these dimensions, da 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 da, press F2, I'm sure it's not that simple at all, and out will come a heart that you can use, but who knows, one day that could be, and the hope is that that will be sooner rather than later, and of course then we won't have to do the shiur at all, we'll talk about something else. If we're still having shiur in 2035-40, then we'll rethink that. Okay, so that's the first thing. Another thing which has changed since we last spoke about this is more and more countries, including my own alma mater, I suppose, Britain, United Kingdom have flipped their approach from an opt-in to an opt-out. Most countries, including Israel, including America, have an opt-in system, which means that unless you carry a donor card, people will assume that you do not wish your organs to be donated. However, some countries, particularly England I mentioned, but I've mentioned others in the footnotes here, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Spain, Austria, Belgium, have an opt-out system, whereby they will assume that you do want your organs to be donated unless you sign a form, which you can do quite easily online, saying, I do not wish my organs to be donated. And that obviously changes the statistics enormously. By way of example, Germany has an opt-in system, and around 12% has had a 12% organ donation consent rate, which is quite low, actually. Austria, which is a very similar country for all intents and purposes, has an opt-out system, and it has a 99.98% organ donor consent. So obviously this flips things completely, but obviously has other issues in terms of people's rights and people's choices, religious issues too. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the ethical and halakhic issues at the beginning, but we'll see some of them. I've listed quite a few of them. Let's just mention a couple of them. When is the moment of death? Is that a medical decision? Or is that a legal decision? We'll see, it's really a legal decision. Is that a religious decision? How does that work? Who decides it? It's doctors, rabbis, priests, who has to make that decision? Who should choose whether to donate organs? What about the family? What if the deceased was quite in favor of donating their organs, but the family says, no, we don't agree with it? How does that work? Or the other way around? Opt-in, opt-out, we mentioned. Who should receive organs? Is it ethical for people to say, I will donate my organs, but only to ... or not to the following people? Is that acceptable on any level? Should organs be sold? You should just know that before the 2008 legislation in Israel, Israel was one of the centers of the world trade in organs, which was a problem because there was a black market and it was very damaging on many levels. But because there were so few organs here, Israel was, if you like, ground zero for that. That was made illegal by the legislation then. Animal organs we mentioned as well. Halakhic issues, we will talk about lots of these. The imperative to save life, wherever halakhically permitted. What is the time of death? We'll see that is the clear and most important issue we'll discuss today. Treatment of a human body after death, the obligation to bury the dead. Is there a mitzvah to give organs after death? And if so, who is that mitzvah on? Is it on the person who died? Well, they're no longer alive. Why do they have any mitzvahs at all? Who is that on? Is it a mitzvah to give organs during life? This has become much more common now since I last gave this shiur 5 or 6 years ago. We will not be talking about live donation in detail, but I know many, many people now who've given a kidney here, other things to family, to non-family. And obviously, as those procedures become more and more routine and safer, then more people will do that. Everybody agrees that that is an enormous act of chesed, whether it's an obligation or a mitzvah, we'll see a little bit in Rav Moshe. I, of course, have a different situation here because I'm British and therefore they think that we all have mad cow disease. And they won't even take my blood, never mind my organs. But maybe they'll change their mind on that. I don't know. So far, I haven't met any British people who have yet turned into mad cows, although it was a real issue. There were some people who never did get something, but they don't know if it tried. So it was like, it's very controversial. But Lamai said they won't take my blood because I'm... And my wife bought my sister-in-law, very British humour, birthday card, where one cow was saying to the other, aren't you worried about mad cow disease? And the other cow responded, why should I worry? I'm a penguin. But if you have to be British maybe to kind of get that. But anyway, so Lamai said they'll take my blood if they really want it. Does a person have to be buried whole? Does it affect Tchias HaMeisim? Many people say this. Usually when you speak to non-observant people, Jewish people, they all say, oh, no, you can't bury your organs because you'll never come back from the dead. Or you can't donate your organs, excuse me, you'll never come back from the dead. Is that real? Is there an iron horror? How does that work? So there are four basic kinds of organ donation. We need to get into the sources now. The one we're really focusing on is the issues of donating organs from a patient who is brain dead. We'll talk about what that means. But there also could be removal of organs from a person whose heart has also stopped This is becoming more and more technologically possible. Removing organs from a deceased who is for sure dead, that's usually not helpful for the recipients. And then, of course, live donor issues, which I mentioned, but we're not going to talk about in depth. So let's start some sources. Let's see how this works. And as I say, I recommend you read all the other material that I mentioned, which I've referred on the sheet. There is, without question, an enormous Jewish imperative to save life. Number one. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, very famous source, Lefikach nivra Adam yechidi, why was Adam Arishon created alone? L'lamdecha, this teaches you, shekol hama'abid nefesh achas, anyone who destroys one life, and there's a girsa issue, either it says mi Yisrael, or doesn't say mi Yisrael. And that, of course, makes a big difference. Is it a Jewish life, or is it any life? And you can go into that in more detail, but let's assume for now, Mi Yisrael, which is the Girsa in our Gemara, is anyone who destroys a Jewish life. Ma'ale ala kosev ki'ilu ibad oila ma'ale. It's as if they destroy the whole world. And v'chala makayim nefesh achas Misrael. And anyone who saves one Jewish life, ma'ale ala v'kosev ki'ilu kaim olam ma'ale. It's as if they saved the entire world. If any of you ever saw the movie Schindler's List, this was a very moving moment when the people gave to Schindler something on which was inscribed this Gemara. If you save one life, it's as if you saved the entire Jewish world. So this for us is an enormous imperative. And a mitzvah as well. Number two. Don't go telling tales about other people. Do not stand by over the blood of your brother, Ani Hashem. There, of course, it says Reyecha. And Reyecha almost always means a fellow Jew, but that's not for the for analysis today. Rashi explains, Lirot b'mizaso, if you could see that somebody else is dying, v'ata yachal atzila, and you have the ability to save them, Kagain Taveya Banahar, someone's drowning, God forbid, in a river, V'chaya Olistim Ba'im Alav, or they're being attacked by animals, or by robbers, or by bandits. You can't stand by, you have an imperative to intervene. Ani Hashem, at the end of the Posik says Arashi, Ne'man L'shalem Scha, I can be trusted to reward those who did help, V'ne'man Lihipara, and I can be trusted to punish those who turned a blind eye. And said, "Oh, I never saw. I didn't. I couldn't involve myself, etc." Now, this is quite unusual. In secular law, in most jurisdictions, there is no obligation to jump in and save people from drowning. In some countries, there is. Many countries they have what's often called a Good Samaritan law. The Good Samaritan law. I'm not getting into the New Testament story of the Good Samaritan for now, but the Good Samaritan law basically usually says that if you do intervene, because you've done a chesed to jump in, even if you didn't have to, and in so doing you hurt, damage, or even kill the person you're trying to save, then you are immune from prosecution because you were trying your best. But sometimes a Good Samaritan law does say that there is some level of obligation to jump in. Here, the Torah says, if it's Reyecha, if it's another Jew, you must. You don't even have a choice. Unless, of course, it's going to damage your life. You don't have to destroy your life in order to save somebody else. But that's a risk analysis, which we talked a little bit about with cosmetic surgery 2 weeks ago. Oh, by the way, last week, if you weren't here, we talked about surrogacy. And it's a very interesting topic. So David already sent out the video from last week. So I would certainly recommend you looking at that shir as well. But here, in Torah, we have an obligation. Why? Why would Torah go so much further than most civil jurisdictions? The answer is because Jews are family. If somebody, well, for whatever reason, doesn't jump in and save a complete stranger, so, you know, that's a problem. They should have done. But at the end of the day, you can't say they had to. But if somebody sees their own family drowning in the sea, God forbid, and they don't jump in, that's a disgrace. And therefore, the halachic position vis-a-vis non-Jewish people in the world at large is pretty much in line with the secular law position, which is, it's a mitzvah, it's very nice, or it's a chesed, but you don't have to. But with a Jew, you have to, because a Jew is family. A little bit like the issue of lending money on interest. There is nothing intrinsically immoral about charging interest, and therefore you can charge interest to people that you lend money to, but to another Jew, a Jewish family, how can you charge your family interest? That is corrupt and immoral, and therefore that's why these differences occur in that way. So there is a mitzvah, and therefore to donate organs to save life is a mitzvah. There's no question about it, but a mitzvah on whom? So if you look here, the Igros Moshe comes in here in the Yoredeh, and he says the following. I'll just deal with this quite quickly. This is not a controversial point. The Rav Moshe Feinstein, we'll see soon, the many very controversial things about Rav Moshe we'll see soon. He says here, Lefi Atan Shekasavti, Delav Deloy Tam Adam Riecha, Hu Bedin Kol Alavin. He's talking first about live donation. This is like any other prohibition. You may not stand by while others are dying or suffering. You are not obligated to even undergo a questionable danger to your life, even to resolve a definite danger to someone else's life. Let's say someone says to you, this person desperately needs a kidney. If they don't have a kidney, they will die, for sure. And for you, it's probably going to be fine, but it could be a little bit dangerous. You don't have to do it, says Rav Moshe. To prevent other negative prohibitions, not only do you not have to avoid those prohibitions, you're not allowed to put yourself in sakana. Let's say a person says, I don't want to eat treif. I don't want to risk it. I don't want to eat treif. And the doctor's saying, yeah, but it's dangerous for you not to eat treif. So you must eat. You have to. You're not allowed to risk your life to avoid doing an avera. The Araba, Adaraba, on the contrary, Hamachalel Shabbos. We break Shabbos. Afluf was misafik sakana. Even if someone's a questionably in danger, we break Shabbos. Kol shekin she'asal achnis atzmo l'safik sakana l'natzel mechilul Shabbos. You're certainly not allowed to put yourself into danger in those situations when we call a lavin for any prohibition. So in theory, this mitzvah lo tamod adam riecha, I should not be required, maybe not even allowed, to endanger myself in order to do this mitzvah like every other mitzvah. The imkain, if this is the case, as Rav Moshe, ein l'chayv l'achnis atzmo l'safik sakana, you are not required to put yourself into questionable danger, gam bishvil l'hatzel nefesh chaveru, even to save another person's life. Aval, but but there is a difference between this mitzvah and other negative mitzvahs. If you don't want to eat treif, we're not going to listen to you. You must eat treif, even if there's a danger, which is a questionable danger to your life, you're not allowed to take that danger. But with this mitzvah, we're going to say you don't have to, but you are allowed to. L'hatzil nefesh chaveru, af shegamkin hu rak be'isa lav, you are allowed in this mitzvah to put yourself into questionable danger. Because at the end of the day, you're saving a Jewish life. So the difference between this mitzvah and other mitzvahs, says Rav Moshe, for live donation is, you don't have to donate the kidney, but in this case, you are allowed to, even though it could be questionably dangerous for you, whereas with every other mitzvah, you would not be allowed to. But in this mitzvah, you are allowed to. And that's why he says it's not a chiyuv, it's a midas chasidus, it's an enormous act of chesed that you did, but you don't have to. And then in the last paragraph, just four lines up from the bottom, he says, and you ask me, he addresses the question here, u'mashikasev kvotarasa she'ein l'chayev gam likach eve mimeis. How would this apply to a dead body? And assuming that the person has died according to all halachic definitions. We'll get there in a minute. Shehu b'zayon, and it's a b'zayon for the mace. A disgrace to a body, desecrating a body, is a Torah prohibition. So are you allowed to do that in order to save somebody's life? Even though I'm going to say you don't have to absolutely, aval mitzvah vaday ikah. He says absolutely clear that there is a mitzvah. Then no question is there's a mitzvah. And this is even better than a live donation, because at the end of the day, you're not endangering your life. You're cutting an organ out of a dead body. You're not endangering their life either. They're already deceased. So the only problem here is desecrating the dead, which is a real issue. But to save a life, what are you talking about? Lotam al dam riecha. So it's interesting. Rav Moshe seems to assume that there is definitely a mitzvah in organ donation from a deceased body, that there is a mitzvah of lotam al dam riecha. But on who is the mitzvah? It makes most sense to say that the mitzvah is on the family, because they are still the people who are obligated in mitzvahs. It's more difficult to argue that the mitzvah is incumbent on the person who's passed away, because the person who's passed away is chafish min ha-mitzvahs. You could say that the mitzvah is to facilitate, if you carry a donor card, that if it's halakhically permitted, I want to save life through donating organs. So that's the hechsher mitzvah. You're putting in place the mitzvah, but it's difficult to say that the person who gives the organs is doing the mitzvah, but the family may definitely be doing the mitzvah. I'm not getting more into that now. Whether the family has permission to give away the organs even though the deceased didn't want it. So that's a big debate as to how that works. Some people say no, some people say yes, but certainly when the person has given permission, the family will be doing a mitzvah if they donate the organs, as long as that's halakhically okay. Now, let's get into the halakhic issues of organ donation. First of all, we'll deal with a few issues other than time of death. And we'll deal with these quite quickly because they are, if you like, secondary to the main issue. First of all, there's a question of burial. We talked about this, we had a share not so long ago on autopsy. You remember that? It was about a year and a half ago. There is a mitzvah in the Torah to bury the dead. Number four, ki yeh be'ish chet mishpat mavet, if a person is liable to the death penalty, v'humat, and they are killed by Beis Din. Now don't forget, Beis Din didn't hang people to kill them. Beis Din had four types of a capital punishment, even though the Gemara says they were almost never done, and it was considered to be almost inappropriate to do them, but in theory they were there, but they were not hanging. But once a criminal, a capital criminal, had been hanged, had been killed rather, for the death penalty, the talita oto ala eitz, then there was a mitzvah to hang up the body after death on a tree. The lotali nivlato ala eitz, do not under any circumstances leave that body overnight. Which, by the way, to us it seems pretty horrendous. Why would you hang up any? It was absolutely standard in the ancient world, and even in Europe until around 400 years ago, that the bodies of criminals were left hanging for months and months and months and months on end. If you'd have gone into any major city in Europe in the Middle Ages, the first thing you would have seen as you walk through the gates is the bodies of all of the people who are the criminals, the capital criminals, hanging until they were decomposed on the walls. The Torah said already 3,000 years ago, you can't do that to anybody. Ki kavortik bereni, you must bury them b'yom ha'hu, on that day. Ki klelas elokim talui, it's an insult for God, or it's an insult to the judges. I'm not getting into the pshat now. You may not be matami the land by having dead bodies hanging up for any more than a few hours. It must be overnight. It must be buried before the day ends or before the next morning. And the Sefer Chinuch in number 5 and number 6 explain there are two mitzvahs. A negative mitzvah and a positive mitzvah, so that there is a prohibition to leave a body unburied, and there is a positive mitzvah that you must bury the body. Look for a second in number 6, in the middle, in the positive mitzvah, midini ha-mitzvah. Masha Amri Zikharan Livrachim She'ein mitzvah zeh benitla levad. It's not only for someone who has been hung up after capital punishment. Ela af kol harugi beistin, for any other person who is a capital criminal, mitzvah l'kovrom b'yom harigatam, it's a mitzvah to bury them, because technically the posuk's talking about someone who was killed by skila. V'gam b'chlal ha-mitzvah l'kvor kol meis misrael b'yom moto. And this applies kal v'chomer to every other Jew, even if they're not a capital criminal. This is an interesting example of where the Torah learns a mitzvah from an extremist case. If already the low-life capital criminal, even he cannot be left overnight unburied, kal v'chomer all the more so a respectable person. There's a couple of other situations where you see that. For example, where are the mitzvahs in the Torah learned as to how a husband should treat his wife, what he should give to her in marriage in terms of support, etc.? Where a person marries the ama ivriya in Parshas Mishpatim. If somebody marries the maid who's sold into the family to marry the son or the father of the family, so you'd have thought, well, come on, I only married the maid. You know, really? She's expecting a whole ksuba and everything? She's lucky to be married to anyone. No. Even if you marry the ama ivriya, you must give her a full settlement. All the more so in other situations where you marry someone who is not the ama ivriya. Another last example is the mitzvah of tzniut. According to the Smack and the Mishnah Berurah Paskas this way, the mitzvah of tzniut is learnt as a Torah mitzvah. It's one of the Tariyag mitzvahs. From where do we learn the mitzvah to be tzanua? Says the Smack, from the mitzvah of keeping the battlefield bathroom clean. That says the Torah in this Pesefer Dvarim, when you're out in battle and everything around you is blowing up and falling apart and everyone's reduced to a much more animalistic existence, because life could be over in seconds. If you need to go to the bathroom, you still have to do it like a mensch. You have to go outside, you have to dig a little hole, you have to have a shovel on your kit, and you have to behave like a mensch. If already you have to behave like a mensch in extremis, kal vachomer, in situations which are less extreme, you have to be aware of your dignity, etc. This, of course, is the opening to a whole discussion on sniut, which is one of the things that people most miss and get wrong when they're talking about sniut, that the fundamental mitzvah of sniut is how a person behaves when there's nobody else there, when no one else can see them, when only between them and God knows how they act in this situation. Once you get other people involved, it's less of a mitzvah of sniut, which is the counterintuitive, the way most people wrongly understand sniut, but that's not for now. Oh, okay, so I am burying this person. I just took their heart and their liver and so look, number seven. Tigvarenu says, Yushami, kula, you have to bury the whole person, v'lo miktzato. You may not leave any part of the person unburied. Also, the Yerushalmi says, Mikan she'im shir mimeno, if you leave any of the body which is unburied, lo asaklum, you didn't do the mitzvah. Everything that is with the person when they die has to be buried with them. And as you know, and I put in the footnotes here, zakah is very particular, doing a job that most people would not want to do, to find all traces of the bodies of those who die in tragic circumstances. There is no requirement, by the way, to have every single bit of a person buried that they had when they were alive, but they decided to get rid of during their life, like their hair or their nail clippings or anything like that. So don't worry, they can be thrown away. Although I brought you here that there are certain stories of people that came afterward. There's a story about the Rambam that Rav Avadi Yosef that brings down, that he came in a dream after his death and asked someone to find his toe that had been amputated some years earlier or time earlier, and apparently his wish was fulfilled and the toe was found and was buried with the ram. Not getting into that now, that was maybe beyond the letter of the law. So that's the issue of burial. So how do we deal with that? What about nivul hamet, disgracing the dead? That's also a Torah mitzvah. You can look at the sources yourself, although I just pull out one issue, which is in number 9. Let's look at number 8 as well. Says the Gemara here, Helina lichvoida, tashma, helina lichvoida, if somebody leaves a mace unburied, but for the covered of the mace, for the honor of the mace, not for the bizayon, so that we can bring a proper coffin, tachrikim, bring proper shrouds. Eina either allow, that's not prohibited. Because when the Torah says you can't leave a person unburied, dum yidatali the east bay bizayon, that's when there's a disgrace. Avalhacha, but here, kaven the lace bay bizayon, there's no disgrace law. So you see here already an opening that maybe it would be permitted to desecrate a body for the purposes of organ donation, because that's not a bizayon. On the contrary, that's a kavod. But really, that's not the answer. The answer is all of these considerations would be set aside completely for pikuach nefesh. All of these prohibitions to bury the dead and not to desecrate the dead, once you have someone's life that is in danger, all of this is completely set to one side. And the Gemara talks about this in a very interesting scenario. Number 9. It talks about a criminal who's been arrested for murder. Now, there's a halacha that if a person murders another one, but the victim was a trafer, someone that would have died probably within the next 12 months from another disease, then that's still murder, but they do not have capital punishment. So the Gemara asks, should we perform an autopsy? There's a murder victim. He was definitely murdered. There's definitely someone who killed them. But we don't know if this victim was a trafer. And that makes a difference, because if they were a trafer, then we shouldn't be killing the criminal. We should put him in jail or whatever we'll do. So the Gemara says, number 9, the chitema de baktin alei, should we check the body? Because we're saving the life of the criminal. Hakamanaval, but aren't you desecrating a body? You're going to do an autopsy on a body? How could you do that? It's a Torah prohibition. Ah, the chitema mishum ibud neshama dahayin anivlele. Because we should do an autopsy to save the life of the criminal, who may be not liable to the death penalty. So the Gemara says, ena chinami. You're right. For that, we would have done an autopsy. But Maybe the autopsy won't work, because when we cut the body open, we will destroy the evidence of where they were a traitor, and therefore it won't really answer the question. But the implication being, if it did answer the question, then nivul hamet is always permitted for pikuach nefesh. So all of these questions will go away. Taking out the organs from a deceased person to save another person's life would be permitted in halacha without question. And I brought you number 10. I'm not going to look at it now. The Node of Yehuda that quite famously says, but it has to be pikuach nefesh lefaneinu. There has to be a real pikuach nefesh opportunity right now. But to do nivul hameitz for some potential maybe in the future there may be lives saved. For example, somebody who wants to donate their body to medical research. Because you never know, maybe this person, you know, this researcher will find the cure for cancer on this body and that'll save millions. That's not called pikuach nefesh lefaneinu. That won't set aside these Torah prohibitions. It has to be lefaneinu. Is organ donation lefaneinu? Almost certainly yes. Given the joined up nature of communications in the world today, there's almost certainly somebody, probably close, but if not, then somewhere you can get to who could be saved by these organs, and therefore let's assume for now that pikuach nefesh lefaneinu will apply in all these situations. So too, benefiting from the dead. There's an issa hana'ah, you're not allowed to get benefit from a body. That will be set aside because of pikuach nefesh. Issues of kapara, issues of whether they consent or not. We just touched on that briefly, but I really want to get into the main discussion, which is time of death. Maybe just a word on tchiyas ha-meisim. Tchiyas ha-meisim is a spiritual idea. And when people say that surely you can't have your organs donated because then you won't be whole in the grave when Tchias HaMesim comes, so there's usually not much left of anybody by the time Tchias HaMesim comes, unless Tchias HaMesim happens mamash like a minute or two after the person has died. And therefore it seems that Tchias HaMesim is a supernatural phenomenon, or maybe a natural one, which it won't matter if the organs are not there. For example, Rav Aryeh Kaplan says that it could be Tchias HaMesim will be achieved through cloning. All we need is a DNA sample, you know, a la Jurassic Park, and we'll find the DNA of this person, and we'll bring them back to life. We don't need organs to be there. We just need a strand of DNA that survives. We'll dig up a bone, and we'll do it from there. And then Rav Aryeh Kaplan says, and even if you don't have the DNA, if you have Eliyahu HaNavi, who is a Navi, he'll give you the code. You'll sit by your computer with your 3D printer or whatever it is, and Eliyahu HaNavi will read you the code, you'll just type it in, and then you'll be able to bring back the person. Whatever. Not for now, but it's not really affected by the issue of organ donation, although I brought you a quote from the Sitz Eliezer, who quotes the Chasam Sofer, that is worried that if a person's eyes are taken away when they're dead, maybe they won't be able to see a Tchias HaMesim. So, but most poskim discount that completely. Now, time of death. Let's talk about this. This is the main event. Death at the end of the day is a legal definition. The lawyers decide who is dead. The doctors ask the lawyers, is he dead? Is she dead? And if they are, then the doctors say, fine, we can move and take away the organs. Because if the lawyers say they're not dead, the doctors do not want to get sued. So at the end of the day, these are legal definitions. And there are many potential moments at which you could define this. For example, I listed in page 5, brainstem death we'll talk about. Cessation of heartbeat, it sometimes happens considerably after. Full body death, the body, the molecular functions within the body live for days after the organism as a whole, after the person themselves is no longer alive. What about somebody who is in a coma? And according to almost all, in fact, as far as I'm aware, all jurisdictions, and certainly halacha, a person in a coma is most definitely not dead, they're most definitely alive. Certain functions of their upper brain are not functioning, but they could recover. Many, many people have recovered from comas, and therefore that person is, chas v'shalom, certainly not in a situation you could define as dead. Someone in a persistent vegetative state could also recover. It's less likely, but it's possible. But someone with a brainstem death, as far as medical science, as far as they're concerned today, is not capable of coming back from that state. And therefore, we'll have a look at whether that could be the definition in halacha of death. There are basically three life support systems within the body. There's the brain, there's the respiratory system of the breathing, and there's the cardiac circulatory system. It was classically always the case in almost every legal jurisdiction that death was defined by heartbeat. Until the last 50, 60 years. If a person's heart was beating, if you had a patient 80, 90 years ago, in a hospital bed, their heart was beating, although they were brain dead, although they couldn't diagnose brain death back then. But if you would have cut open that person and taken their organs away, you would have been a murderer, pure and simple. In Texas, you'd have got the chair, there's no question about that. Now that definition has been changed. In almost all of those places where heartbeat was the definition of death, now it's brain death. So if a person goes to the same patient in 2021 and does the same thing, not only are they not a murderer, but they're a hero. They save this life, and they save that life, and they save the other life. This is a legal definitional change. The medicine has changed in the sense that we can diagnose more, but at the end of the day, this person was in the same situation. So we need to work out what is the case in halakha. We're not just going to change halakhic definitions based on the utilitarianism of being able to save their organs. Because there's always a niggling question, isn't there? Why did the law change? Did the law change because we're now more advanced, we can understand the body better, or did the law change because there's now something we can do with a brain-dead patient that we couldn't do 60 years ago, which sounds off in halacha? The fact that we can save other people's lives is not going to be any justification for killing people. That's for sure. The one thing you cannot do, or one of the things you cannot do to save life, is to take someone else's life. So is that why this definition changed? Did it change because there's a lot of pressure on hospital beds, and the doctors don't feel that it's justifiable, economical, whatever, to keep people who are brain dead indefinitely alive, in which case, again, that doesn't sit well with us at all, that it's being done for economic decisions? Is there a suggestion that it's a mercy to take someone off a life-saving the machinery when they are in a brain dead state? Is that, and also that won't sit with us either. Killing someone, even if person thinks it's a mercy killing, I brought you a note there, the Ksava HaKabbalah on Breishis specifically learns that this is also prohibited. But at the end of the day, if halacha says that a brainstem dead person is indeed dead, okay, so then they're dead, and then it's a mitzvah to take the organs and to save other people's lives. So let's have a look at that now. There's lots of pictures and diagrams and things like that. We'll hopefully work it all out. So, 16, a goysis. What is a goysis? A goysis is a person who is, God forbid, close to death, but not yet dead. And everyone agrees that a goysis, says number 16, Hari hu kachai l'chal dvarav. Even if a person is, God forbid, but in the last minutes of life, they are still halachically alive. Shach comes in and says, the osalaso is dava hamakariv misaso. You're not allowed to do anything which in any way brings forward, actively brings forward the moments of death. Therefore, ein kosher lechayav, you may not tie up the cheeks. Ve ein sachinoso, you may not apply oils. Ve ein madichinoso, you may not wash the person. Ve ein ma'amsin einav, agitate enough, you may not close their eyes. You may not do anything that could hasten death. If a person, God forbid, closes the eyes of a goyses before they're dead, Hari ze shofech damim, that's murder. So any active step that may bring forward the end of life is prohibited. So there are more ads. You're not allowed to do anything which makes the person die more quickly. Someone who's been lingering for many, many days and their soul will not depart. You may not take the pillow from under their head. That will bring forward death. You can't move them. Move the pillow, etc. And here's an interesting point. If there's something external that is stopping the person from passing away, near the place where the person is in hospital, there's a noise knocking. Someone's chopping wood, and this is stopping the person from passing away. And that's stopping the person from dying. You're allowed to stop the wood chopper and allow the person to peacefully pass away. That's not called an act. You're just removing something which is preventing the person passing away. Now that's a very interesting analysis, because how that applies to removing life-saving care from machinery that the person is connected to in life support systems, how that applies is a very major debate. Is removing somebody from life support considered to be actively bringing forward the time of death, or simply removing an external criteria that is stopping the person from dying? And there's a very, very large amount of death on this, which I'm not getting into now. End-of-life issues are very complex, and you need a posik who is familiar with the individual case and also very familiar with the halacha. But that's where it comes from. It's this decision, it's this discrepancy between active involvement and negative taking something away. And other areas of halacha as well, by the way. If I have a candle on the table and I open the window, so now the air is coming in, is going to put the candle out. I'm not allowed to do that on Shabbos. But if I have an open window and a candle is flickering because of the air, the breeze that's putting it out, I'm allowed to close the window, even though that will make the candle burn more strongly, a stronger flame, because that's taking away the thing that's preventing the candle from burning. And that's an important distinction which is relevant here too. But everyone agrees that a person who's, God forbid, a goyseis, you may not do anything to them actively which in any way brings forward their death. The question is, how do I know if somebody is a goyseis or not? So I brought you a little bit of material on page 6 as to what brain death is. Again, I'm not a doctor and I'm not going to give you a medical analysis. But at the end of the day, the brain is basically can be divided between the upper brain function, and a person in a coma or a persistent vegetative state is lacking some of the upper brain function, and the brain stem at the bottom with the lower brain function, which is much more fundamental. The upper brain function regulates the activities that we do in life. Normally, thinking and music and cognition, etc. The brain stem is much more fundamental. That is the place that influences spontaneous breathing. Without an active brainstem, without the brainstem being still alive and oxygenated, a person is not capable of independent respiration. And therefore, the suggestion is, as the medicine has moved forward, that a person whose brainstem is no longer functional is medically dead. And the question is that person halakhically dead or not? Whether there can be any other brain activity after brainstem death is a bit controversial. In medical society as well. According to some studies, even after brainstem death, there is some brain activity of different kinds. But one thing is for sure, as far as I'm aware, no one has yet come back and recovered from a situation of a brainstem death. Now, what does the halacha say? So let's have a look. There are two main sugyas. The primary sugya is in Yuma. Number 17. First of all, let's start with the pasuk in Noach. Again, what are we asking here? We're asking whether halachic definition of death is respiration, breathing, which is controlled by the brainstem, or heartbeat, which is not. And that's very important. If the brainstem dies, but there is oxygen coming in from outside through artificial life support, the heart will continue beating even if there's no brain there at all. The heart has an independent mechanism whereby it beats independently of the brain. In fact, one of the most fascinating things I ever saw is a video of when a baby's heart begins to beat. At what point does a fetus's heart start beating? It's a fascinating thing. Actually, as the stem cells start to differentiate between different kinds of organ cells, the cells that become heart cells as individual cells go like this. They have a built-in sort of beat to them. And when one little heart cell inside the fetus, very early days, meets another one, and they're all beating independently, they start beating together, and they fall into rhythm with each other, and that's how the heart works. It's got nothing to do with the brain. The heart will beat as long as it's got oxygen. Fascinating. So the Gemara in Yuma basically analyzes as follows. Number 17. Kol asher nishmas ruach chaim ba'apav. Any in the flood, all those who had the breath of life in their nose, mikol asher b'charava, on the dry land, mesu. Okay? So breathing. It sounds like those who breathe are alive, and those who cease to breathe die. Gemara, number 18. Tana Rabbana, ad heichan hu boidek. What's the scenario here? As follows. Somebody, God forbid, is trapped in a building on Shabbos and the building collapses. We don't know if there's someone in there. There might be someone in there. We don't know if they're dead or alive. There's many things that we don't know. We are obligated to break Shabbos in every way possible to ascertain whether there is someone whose life we could save in there. And even if every rock that we pick up is another Chilul Shabbos, we have to break Shabbos. So we find a body. We don't know if they're alive or dead. How far do we check? Meaning once we know this person is, God forbid, no longer alive, then we can't break Shabbos anymore. We can't be Mechalel Shabbos sitting on a Torah level for a person who's no longer alive. We can't Pikuach Nefesh. Says the Gemara, Ad Chaitma, we check to the nose. V'yesh Omrim, Ad Liboy. Another opinion, we check to the heart. Interesting. That sounds like a machlokas, whether breathing is what defines you as alive, and we check the nose, or heartbeat. Amar Rav Papa says, machlokas mi mata lamala. The machlokas is only if we found the person feet first, and we keep checking. Then one view says you check to the heart, and if there's no heartbeats, then they're not alive. The other view says you check to the nose. Aval mi lamala lamata. But from the top down, Kevan de bada klei ad chaitzma, once you've reached the nostrils, shuv einu tzarech. That's as far as you need to go. Why? Dichsiv kol asher nishmas ruach chaim ba'apav. Brings a pasuk in Noah. Breathing, it seems, says Rav Papa, is all you really need. The heartbeat is only if you're going from the bottom up. Then there are some people that say, well, the heart's enough, or maybe you have to go to breathing. But where you go from the top down, the breathing is definitive. The Yerushalmi actually leaves out the entire mention of the heart. Look in number 19. It says the Yerushalmi, Nafla lo mapolid, if a building falls down, Bafakim alav bishvil Yisrael shalasham, we have to, you know, search for any Jew that might be trapped there. Ad Eichen, how far do we search on a body? Trainam Orayim, there are two different views on this. Chad ama ad chaitmo, one says to the nostrils. V'chor na'ama, and the other one says ad tiburo, to the navel, to the diaphragm. Now both of these are breathing. There isn't even any mention of the heart in the Yerushalmi. We either check the nostrils to see if there's breath, or we check the diaphragm to see if there's breathing. So according to this, it sounds like breathing is pretty much everything. And the Rosh, and the Ram, and the Rif quote the wording of the Yerushalmi. Look at number 20. Tana Rabbanon, ad heichen hu boidek, ad tiburo v'yesh omnim ad choitmo. The navel, or the nose, it sounds like breathing is pretty much everything. And the Shulchan Aruch, look in 22. Ama afilu moitzar murutzat. Even if a person finds, God forbid, a body who is crushed, there's no way this person can survive in the long term. She'eni ochelichas ela lefisha. They can only survive for moments. Nevertheless, mefakim aboikim ad chaitma. Nostrils, breathing. You check for the breathing. If you don't find any life in the breathing of the person, as vadai meis, then they're definitely dead. It doesn't matter whether you found them head first, tchila. We paskin that the breathing is definitive. You always have to take the breathing. And it sounds from the Shulchan Aruch that the heartbeat is far less relevant, if relevant at all. Based on this sugya, and it's much more complicated than I've been able to tell you, many poskim, specifically Rav Moshe Tendler, who passed away just a few months ago, was very, 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 very clear that as far as halacha is concerned, breathing and only breathing is the relevant consideration, which in modern medical terms means brainstem death. Given a person, if a person has a functioning brainstem, which could happen, by the way, if they had if the blood pressure in the brain exceeds because of a swelling or an injury, the blood pressure of the heart to pump blood up, so then the brain will no longer receive oxygen, and if the brain no longer receives oxygen, the brainstem dies, says Rav Moshe Tendler, that is it. Now, why is this important for organ donation? Because if you wait to donate organs until the heartbeat has ceased, then the organs deoxygenate very, very quickly, and they're not much use to anybody. Nobody who has a kidney that's not functioning needs another kidney that's functioning even worse. Okay? Therefore, it's really only possible to donate organs if brainstem death is the halakhic definition of death. That's the key. If you have to wait for the heart to stop, there'll be pretty much nothing that you can donate. The cornea maybe, skin grafts maybe, but anything internal will no longer be viable, and therefore only if brainstem death is halakhically acceptable will organ donation be possible. And says Rav Moshe Tendler, it is halakhically acceptable. You see this from the sugya here, and we'll see again soon, that this is the definition of death, and he very strongly campaigned, as did Rav Avram Steinberg and others, we'll see the list in a minute, that this has to be the definition of death. And obviously the Halakhic Organ Donor Society, which is promoting donation of organs, very strongly takes this view, based on the poskim that say, this sugya and others will see, indicate that breathing and not heartbeat is relevant. However, it's not so straightforward. Look at Rashi, number 23. Rashi says, what is this debate going on? The Mar Amar, Belibo yesh lahavchin im yesh bo chiyas. One view says the heartbeat is relevant, see if the heart's beating. Shenishmaso doifeket sham, that's where his nefesh is beating in his heart. Umar Amar, and the other view, which is breathing, says breathing, why? Ad chotzmo, why? Look carefully. Dezimnin ein chiyas nika beliboy, because we may not be able to tell if the heart's beating. Not that the heart's not relevant, that the heart may not be definitive. People are screaming, there's buildings falling down, there are people who are trying to save people, find people. You're going to try and find a heartbeat? It's not necessarily possible, it'll be very faint. That's why you have to check the breathing. Maybe it'll be visible in the breathing. And therefore Rashi, also number 24, says, Im doime lemeis, if the person is dead, clearly, she'ein meizis evarov, there's no movement. There's no movement in their body at all. Ad heichin hum mafakech, where do you check? Ledata emes, to know that this is the truth. No movement? How can you say that somebody, according to this, whose heart is beating away inside them, is a body in which there's no movement? There is movement. Okay, the person's not moving around, but their internal organs are all functioning. So certainly according to Rashi and many others that go down this line, say, look, this is not a definitive sugya to show that respiration and therefore brainstem death is the determinant of halakhic death. Because a person who is brainstem dead, their body is moving in all sorts of ways. It's just not moving around the room. It's moving internally. Yes? Okay. Correct. Okay, well that's different. It's not that their brainstem is dead and they're not able to breathe. It's that the other functions in the body are making it very hard for them to breathe. There's no question that person's alive. Correct. But again, when a person's brainstem is alive, everybody agrees that they're alive. Here, if the only question is if the brainstem is dead, is that enough? Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of the most controversial figures in this whole sheet, in number 26, he says he's not prepared in this tshuva to define breathing alone. Look at what he says. When we say that breathing is the life from Parshas Noach, it doesn't mean that's the only determinant of life. She said, "Vaday leka b'chaytzma." Because life doesn't exist in the nose, obviously. Ela ruach chaim she'anu rayim. It's only when we can see. It's the test that we can do. Ikav apav. That's in the breathing. Even we can't see this in other limbs, but Avery had to know it in the limbs of the movement. And therefore, Rav Moshe in his early tshuvas indicates pretty clearly that he doesn't feel that breathing alone is sufficient to determine time of death. The question is, did Rav Moshe keep that opinion, or did he change his opinion through life? And we'll get to that in a few minutes. There is another very important Mishnah. Have a look in number 28. Number 28. Adam einu matame ad shetetze nafsho. A person is only tame once they're alive. A person who is dead, or an animal that's dead, lahavdil, generates tuma. They have to be dead. How do we know when they're dead? Afilu goseis, even if they're goseis, as we said, still alive. That's no question. V'chein behema v'chaya einu matame ad shetetze nafsho. A behema also, for tuma snevela, is only tame when they die. Now, Hutsu Rashehem, what if we have somebody whose head has been chopped off? Sorry, it's a little bit gory this year, I apologize. Someone who has no head anymore. Says the Mishnah, Afal pi shemafarchasim, even though the person might be twitching, or the animal might be twitching, Tameim, they're dead, they're for sure dead. Why? It's like the tail of a lizard that might still be twitching even though the lizard is for sure a goner. There's no head on the lizard. You can't read anything into that. It doesn't mean the person's alive. It's just involuntary twitching. Okay. So comes along the Gemara and says, similarly, number 29, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Nishbru Marakeh, if a person's neck, God forbid, is broken, V'roi Basa Ima, and then the flesh, most of the flesh is severed, Matami Be'ohol, they're dead. There's nothing to talk about. That person's dead. Ah, there's movement. Ignore it. They're completely dead. Comes along Rav Moshe Tendler, and Rav Aaron Steinberg and others, and says, okay, somebody who is brainstem dead is physiologically decapitated. They have no connection between the brain and the body anymore. That's the equivalent of this Mishnah. And therefore, I don't care if there are other things moving. If there are other things moving, the Mishnah already said, those movements don't indicate life. They indicate residual neurological activity. The person, or the animal, in this case, the person is clearly dead. And therefore, physiological disconnection is the same as physical disconnection. And that's another proof that they bring. And I brought you two tshuvas of Rav Moshe in number 30, number 31. We don't really have enough time. Maybe we should have done the shiur over two sessions, but I think it's gory enough over one session. You're ready for something else next time. The two tshuvas of Rav Moshe in number 30 and 31 seem to move much more towards this definition. To the point that in 31, this is from a letter that was published after Rav Moshe died, he clearly states in number 31 that brainstem death is the definition of death. The big question is this letter authoritative? Rav Moshe never saw this letter. It was produced afterwards. It's included in the 8th volume of Igros Moshe. If anyone's into the background of how the Igros Moshe was produced, there are a lot of people that were concerned that those tshuvas that were published after Rav Moshe died were not Rav Moshe's final view on things. They were very influenced by other people in the family, and therefore there are many people that question whether this tshuva of Rav Moshe in 31, which clearly says that talks about the Harvard criteria, which are the definitions medically of brainstem death, there is a big question as to whether Rav Moshe is or is not really behind this. I brought you just, the rest is really just summary. If you look on page number 9 and 32, I brought you Dr. Rosner, which summarizes that Rav Tendler believed strongly that Rav Moshe Feinstein, his father-in-law, took the view that brainstem death was death. Certainly Rav Steinberg as well. And I brought you the summary of who is for and who is against. Basically, the people who are for the definition of brainstem death are, as I said, Rav Tendler, Rav Steinberg, the Rabbanut in Israel, which is strongly behind the idea of brainstem death as the definition of death, many of the senior poskim in the religious Zionist world, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, Rav Avram Shapiro, I mentioned Rabbi Dr. Abraham Steinberg, they clearly support this definition of death, and as long as you're confident the doctors have got it right, and there are checks and balances in place, and the 2008 legislation puts all sorts of checks and balances in place, then those people are very confident that that person is allowed to, and even obligated to donate their organs in order to save the life of how many other people? However, against, there is a significant number of very senior poskim that don't accept these arguments. Number one. They say that the Gemara in Yuma is not a good proof because it's not clear why we ignore the heart. Maybe we just can't find the heart. Maybe it's there, but it's just too faint. And the heart is moving. Rashi said the person has to be clearly without any movement. And what about the decapitation analogy? It's not analogous. It's completely different as to physically decapitate somebody and to physiologically argue that this is the equivalent of. And surely the heartbeat is nothing even comparable to the twitching of the tail of a lizard. You can't compare those two things at all. And therefore many, many senior poskim in the Haredi world in Israel, certainly from the last generation, Rav Waldenberg, the Tzitzeliezer, Rav Weiss, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Vosner, and interestingly, almost all of the senior poskim in the OU1YU world in Yeshiva University are very against the definition of brainstem death, which is very interesting. So if you look in, for example, the Psakim of Rav Mordechai Willig, Rabbi Dr. J. David Bleich, Rav Herschel Schechter, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, they were very against the definition of brainstem death, either because they felt that it's just wrong, or that it's a suffix, and in a suffix you can't risk, God forbid, murdering somebody in order to save the lives of other people. So where does that leave you? That leaves you with a very, very major and unresolved machlokas between two very, very significant groups of Rabbonim as to, you know, what is and isn't acceptable. At the end of the day, this is a classic answer, which is you have to ask your local Orthodox posek, and I suggest you only ask one. Because if you ask more than one, then you'll be back where you started. I brought a couple of other issues on the sheet here. One interesting question is it permitted to accept organs even if you don't want to give your organs? Now, the Israeli legislation wants people to not do that. And therefore, it says that if you carry a donor card, then even if it's never, you know, even if you never get to use it, you'll be given priority. If you need an organ transplant from somebody else, the fact that you were willing, at least in principle, to give your organs pushes you up the line. But you'll see here, Rav Shlomo Zalman said, just because you won't give, it is still halakhically acceptable to receive. And I brought you in the footnotes here a very interesting article of Rav Breitowitz, which I recommend that you look at, who goes through all of the issues here. Organ donations to non-Jews. Rav Moshe Tendler is very clear that it is very important to donate organs to non-Jewish people to save their lives. And there are all sorts of arguments about why that might be. I heard from a senior posek in London who told me that he heard from senior Jewish doctors in London that even though they're not allowed to do this officially, if the doctors know that Jewish people don't give organs, that will, if only subliminally, make them less inclined to prioritize a Jewish patient to receive organs, because they say, why should the Jews get when they're not prepared to give? Now, obviously, no one's going to say that officially, but even if that's happening unofficially, that's a reason why this becomes a very major halakhic issue. We must save non-Jewish lives if, in the long run, not only the non-Jewish life, but the Jewish lives will be saved as well. And as I said, Bezrat Hashem, we'll be able to just print the organs off in 20 years and people will live long and happy lives and not have to worry about this problem. Even if you have to live with a baboon heart, there are worse things in life. And if that makes you hale and hearty, hopefully you won't get up to any monkey business, even if you have one. So please God, it should be Refuah Shleima. For Daniel, Raphael, Ben, Leah, we should never know from any need for hospitals or organ transplants. And next time, as I say, Rav Berzin will be here, and we will resume this in 4 weeks with my sharing. Yes, it would be interesting to hear.